Support for this KQED podcast comes from Walmart Labs, based in Silicon Valley. Powered by its own open source technology, Walmart Labs engineers code in an agile DevOps environment. Learn more about engineering and big data positions at walmartlabs.com.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on the Forum program, a new study released this week out of UC Berkeley concludes that urban displacement and what is called gentrification in the Bay Area are not yet half over. We'll discuss it next. Then, in the bottom half of the hour, the award-winning comedy troupe, once called America's Monty Python, Duck's Breath Mystery Theater, regulars on NPR through the 1980s, will be joining us as they prepare for their final reunion tour. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. A team of University of California, Berkeley researchers has more bad news about rising prices in the Bay Area. We're not halfway through the gentrification and displacement we're likely to experience, and that's according to the Urban Displacement Project, which released an interactive map showing the areas most vulnerable to forces that drive low-income residents out. In this opening half hour, we talk about the neighborhoods at the highest and lowest risk of continued gentrification and talk about ongoing gentrification. Joining us in studio is Miriam Zook. She is project director for the Urban Displacement Project on this study, senior researcher at UC Berkeley, in affiliation with the Institute of Governmental Studies and the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Also have Dan Brecke with us in studio. He is blogger and online editor for KQED and edits NewsFix, KQED's blog about news in the Bay Area and beyond. And Dan has done a yeoman's job, as usual, about blogging about this, which you can find on our website. Dan, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Let me begin, if I may, Miriam, with you. There are nine neighborhoods that you study here in six Bay Area counties, and I want to get into some of the details. But I think one of the takeaways may have to do with the fact that we're becoming a giant country club here. Is that what this seems to you? I mean, just from the study and what resulted? This is what I've heard is one of the takeaways, at least.
Well, certainly there's the risk of that happening. That's what the study found. I think one of the things that we're trying to caution is that, you know, there's nothing that we're saying that this is inevitable. We're not saying that this is inevitable, that there are things that can be done, policies that can be enacted, investments that can be made to prevent us from becoming homogeneous.
But you are doing forecasting here, and the forecasting shows, and the map is on our website too, pretty strong, I'll use meteorologist language here, early warning signs.
Right. So we are trying to show what are those places that we believe are at risk. Forecasting might be a little bit different, where we would project out prices and some of these characteristics that are included in our maps. But right now we're saying that we believe that that there are actually more neighborhoods at risk of gentrification and displacement than have already experienced it.
And the map will offer people a tool. I know you want the public to use this map, and I hope they will avail themselves of it. You can certainly have a great deal of data here, but what areas particularly are vulnerable right now?
So what we're finding is that areas that are vulnerable, and I should say that we distinguish between gentrification and displacement because there are places that we don't think of as gentrifying, right? San Mateo, neighborhoods where there are low-income households living there, but you wouldn't think of it as a gentrifying neighborhood, and they are at risk of displacing low-income households. So we looked at these, whereas gentrification, we're thinking about low-income, majority low-income neighborhoods that are experiencing demographic change into higher income, as well as significant investment, specifically in real estate. So places that we are finding that are vulnerable to gentrification and displacement, turns out that the factors predicting these phenomena are similar, are places that are accessible. They're these neighborhoods that we all desire, right? They're accessible. They have usually a a subway stop or BART stop in nearby. They're walkable, so you can walk to great amenities in them, things that people want in their neighborhoods. They have historic housing stock, so it's, you know, it has the strong bones that real estate agents like to talk about in a neighborhood. And we're seeing that the market is strong in those places. So not just that rents are going up, but also development is a lot of market rate development is happening in there. And development happens in places where developers can make profit.
And yet there's some stable places, too, that fall into this category under this umbrella. Dan Brecke, I mean, you know, you look at displacement crisis. It's not half over. Gentrification is ongoing. But you have certain areas, Chinatown, East Palo Alto, for example, Marin City, that remain pretty stable.
Well, it's interesting that you name those three because those are three case studies that are in the researcher's report. What those places share in common, and I'm ready to be augmented by Ms. Zook here, is one, if you look at them, they've tended to be low income areas. They're preferential areas for low income people. But number two, they have policies in place or there's been community organizing that's helped keep them stable. So measures like rent control, where in the case of Marin City, which you mentioned, I mean, the entire history of the community is about affordable housing. I mean, it was built as a, I mean, it's not a de rigueur or polite term anymore, but it's built as a housing project essentially. And to the extent that that legacy continues, those places have remained stable. I will add, though, that in the case of Chinatown, we've done some reporting recently. Stephanie Martin, one of our reporters, has been out talking about how along the edges of Chinatown, the same kind of pressure, which is just driven by real estate speculation and the obvious value that's there right on the edges and sometimes more in the interior, is driving the same kind of process, and people really are at risk of being forced out of even Chinatown.
Yeah, what was that story I read? Some fellow came back to his place in Chinatown. There was a different lock on his door.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it was simply a matter of somebody who had a plan to, you know, get more value and actually sort of transition this hotel, which has been largely a residential hotel, into a tourist hotel.
And what about subsidized housing? I mean, that's one of the stabilizing factors too, isn't it?
Well, it has been, but, you know, there hasn't been a lot of government support or actually there's been plenty of government support if you just look at the bottom line in terms of dollars. But maybe what there hasn't been, and this is an interesting focus of this research, is to marry that kind of support for affordable housing with some of the other policies that government is interested in. And for instance, this report was driven by an assessment of what will it do to various communities if government, if various state and local agencies go ahead with development plans that are driven by our desire to respond to climate change, for instance, you know, planning communities so there are fewer vehicle miles traveled and that kind of thing. And so I think one of the, you know, I don't want to put words in the mouth of somebody who's a postdoc where I don't have a college degree, but I think what they're talking about partly is marrying those two things. You know, one policy for supportive housing with another one, which is, you know, has the laudable goal of improving communities and accessibility and that kind of thing, which could, in fact, touch off gentrification.
It's also, just to talk about different areas here in San Francisco, we had Randy Shaw on not too long ago, and we were talking about the Tenderloin, and it is sort of immune in some ways because speculators can't get in there, really.
That's right, and there's been a very lively narrative this year especially, or in the past year, between there's sort of a dialectic involving Gary Kamiya and Randy Shaw about what can and should be done in the Tenderloin in terms of housing stock and improving the quality of life.
The other thing we learned from your study, Miriam, is that neighborhoods are under some serious stress as far as changes, even if they're bordering a neighborhood where gentrification is going on. So in terms of stabilization, I mean, for example, you write about Marin City, which is an interesting example in itself. But also, thinking about Marin County, the Canal District, which has stayed pretty much in this fairly affluent community, not affluent, and not open that much to gentrification.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to look at the specific characteristics of each community. Certainly, proximity to higher income neighborhoods does result in housing pressures, right? But the characteristics of the Canal neighborhood, in part, it's cut off physically from the rest of San Rafael. It has a lot of industrial uses. There's reasons that perhaps the housing pressures are not accelerating that quickly there where it is in other areas. But again, yeah, all of these neighborhoods, these are places where people have, because they're surrounded by affluence, they are anxious. They're anxious that there's going to be gentrification and that they're going to be pushed out and there's going to be no place for them to find to live anywhere nearby.
And go back to Chinatown for a minute, Dan Brecky. I mean, there's real anxiety there, fear of eviction. Concern,
well,
great concern.
Yeah, and there is.
It's prime, as you said. Yeah.
What's
that? Because it's prime.
Yes, it is. And I think the issue there is, you know, there. If you look at the demographic, you know, settlement pattern right now of San Francisco, there are places where you could see people going from Chinatown. They're not preferred because there's nothing like the community and cultural support that Chinatown has and has had for a long, long time.
Well, I'm going to open the phone lines. I know there's a lot of concern, as we found in many programs that we've done, with displacement, with gentrification. And now there's a new study out, and you can look at the map. It's on our website, kqed.org, and find out exactly what this means for perhaps an area that you are in. And there's a lot of – in fact, we'll talk a little bit more about the data that you have here. I mean, it's kind of a – well, a tsunami of data that you've gone through.
It's a lot of data. We looked at – data from 1990 to 2013. So really trying to get sort of the long perspective, right? Because neighborhood change doesn't, although it feels like it's happening overnight, it's been a long time. Places are being primed for change by cities, by developers, by all sorts of actors. So we looked at all sorts of data, a lot of census data and demographics data, which unfortunately doesn't come as close to today as we want, but it does give us a good understanding of how neighborhoods are changing. We looked at assessor data to try to understand better the housing stock, sales data. We looked at vacancy data. We looked at a lot of data.
A lot of stuff, yeah. Well, let's have our listeners bring in whatever data they'd like to in the way of opinions, thoughts, questions, or comments. Let me give you the phone number. You can join us now at our toll-free number. That number is 866-733-6786. Like to hear your thoughts. Like to hear any questions you might have. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but please feel free to join the program. Here's a listener who writes online, when I was a kid, my parents, two teachers, bought their home in a not bad part of San Jose and eventually paid it off. At the time, it was probably twice their annual wages. Today, a house in San Jose is 20 times the annual wage of a teacher. Rent has risen commensurately so that someone working as a janitor or retail clerk must commute for an hour to get to an affordable housing from their workplace. This is why it's impossible for downtown San Francisco to find enough retail clerks. Next time you're huffing about the bad service at your $1,000 handbag shop, know that that's the reason. But yes, it is a crisis, which is destroying a lot of lives that used to be happier. No doubt about that. And certainly, Dan, this is something that you have seen firsthand.
Yeah, and one thing that I want to remark upon is that one finding of the researchers is we hear a lot about increasing housing supply. So people talk about, in essence, building our way out of this problem. And I think one finding of the research is that's probably not a viable alternative, that there needs to be some kind of a policy shift and other measures taken in coordination with building more housing.
Well, and here's another point of view. Miriam, I believe you wanted to say something, though, in response to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know that the jobs market is so strong here and the housing market is so strong that although we do need more supply, there's no question about that. Nobody's saying we should stop developing market-rate housing. But we need to make sure that there's also, alongside that, more affordable housing and policies.
I have to tell you, recently a friend of mine told me about a young man who recently came into some money because of being in a startup. And he wanted to buy a place in San Francisco, 800 square feet. Now, that's a room. 800 square feet. He has a concierge and he has a gym. But over $1 million. I mean, that's where we are now. But here's another listener point of view, a listener who writes online. Isn't it a little hysterical to describe what is happening in the Bay Area as a displacement crisis? Housing costs in the Bay Area have traditionally been higher than the rest of the United States. Gentrification, put in quotes, has resulted in formerly blighted neighborhoods like the Mission District and Potrero Hill becoming somewhat cleaner and safer. Is that such a deplorable thing? East Palo Alto, which is described by the Berkeley Report as an island of affordability, has one of the highest per capita murder rates on the West Coast. Why would anyone describe this as a success story?
Well, I saw that comment right before I came in here, and I didn't have a chance to look up the statistic on violence in East Palo Alto, but I do believe that was during the crack epidemic.
It has come down a lot.
I think, you know, we do want to see revitalization. We want to see neighborhood improvement, especially in some of these neighborhoods that have been disinvested in historically. But we want to see that benefiting also the people who are already living there.
And another listener writes, what happens to the people who are displaced? Are they less valuable than the neighborhood, which is so improved? It's the people of the Mission that make the place what it is, culturally, socially. It's sad to see them forced from their homes and losing their community. And one more comment from a listener online. The free market, so beloved by Republicans, will inevitably gentrify the Bay Area, forcing out most workers who will then have to commute in from the outer Bay Area and beyond as far as Stockton and Los Baños. Nothing will change that short of big government defending the rest from the rich and dramatic interventions. Unfortunately, the ideology of the rich, libertarianism, has been promoted diligently for decades by a vast network of media, pundits, and purchased politicians who preach government bad business, good from every direction. Anyone who gainsays this is accused of being a socialist, which usually ends the discussion. Something about these listeners, they don't have strong opinions. Right? let me get some callers in here. And James, we begin with you. Good morning, James.
Good morning. For better or for worse, 22 years ago, I left the Bay Area and moved to Brooklyn, New York, and I was one of those early gentrifiers in Brooklyn. I've now come back to San Francisco, and what's interesting is that I'm watching the process repeat itself now in San Francisco, but my main observation is that as the neighborhood changed, these people don't stay. So a lot of what had been the social infrastructure, churches, outreach groups, support that was based in the community basically goes away and evaporates, and the social support infrastructure of these neighborhoods is never replaced. Also, a lot of these high-value apartments and condominiums and complexes are owned by people who are not living there and end up becoming Airbnb or rentals, and it has sort of a Swiss cheese patchwork quilt effect on neighborhoods. And I wanted to get your panel's opinion on what the long-term effect of this is going to be on San Francisco.
All right. Let's get some responses from either of you, both of you. Dan, you want to begin?
Well, I think the consensus is that this is a pattern that threatens to make the city, and there have been demographic studies and economic studies that have pointed in this direction, make it a very homogeneous place over the next generation or so, up through, say, 2040.
You could argue that it's already becoming that.
Well, you could argue that, but I mean there are degrees of difference, and right now the city is still a diverse place. Mm-hmm. There is talk about imposing a moratorium on market rate development in the Mission District, just as a pause to see if there is a way of balancing the development picture there. Now, you know, we'll see if, number one, that's passed, and also if it is passed, it's expected to be on the ballot this fall, impact it will have. But I mean, that's the kind of thing that we're going to start seeing here and elsewhere to try to put the brakes as people see the changes that they're not happy with.
Yeah. Miriam.
And I just add to that, you know, that it takes a while to figure out what the right solutions are. And so I think what we're hearing from this moratorium idea is, we need some space to breathe, right, and figure out how to solve these crises. But going back to the question about sort of what are the impacts, there's been a lot of research actually on the impacts of displacement, largely in refugee communities. And one of the biggest ones, as the caller mentioned, is the impacts on social networks and social support networks. And so we did some work, some case study work here in the Mission, and they talked about how, you know, when before neighbors could rely on each other to babysit, or if you needed a cup of sugar, you know, things that we traditionally think about in terms of neighborhoods, that those are slowly falling apart because people are getting dispersed throughout the region and sometimes outside of the region.
And again, Miriam Zook is the project director of the Urban Displacement Project on this study that we're talking about. And you can see the map on our website, kqed.org. Thomas writes, there's two main driving forces behind gentrification in the Bay Area: tech workers who purchase expensive homes as a way of diversifying away from the stock market, and wealthy people from outside the U.S. doing more or less the same thing. If the one or more of these gravy trains stop flowing, prices will correct accordingly. What won't happen, however, is for many neighborhoods and core urban centers to decline in value all the way back to their pre-boom levels. And let me bring another caller on here. And we go to Redwood City, and we welcome you. James, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah, welcome. Go ahead.
Yes, I would just like to make a comment. I was listening to your program here and about gentrification. I would just like to let you guys know what I've experienced here in Redwood City and what I've seen. Recently, there was an apartment here right down the street from me, and they actually served 18 families an eviction notice because they want to, I guess, Google or somebody bought it, and they want to fix it up and then jack up the rent. And that's kind of the same thing I experienced myself as well when my apartment recently, they just raised my rent from $1,500 to $2,400 for a little one bedroom. And I'm just, you know, and then I got accepted for housing here out of San Mateo County, but I can't get a landlord to accept it just because of, you know, the market, how it is. And I'm just noticing a change because I've lived here all my life, and my aunt bought her house for $120,000 about 20 years ago. For, you know, now her house is worth almost $700,000 to $800,000, you know. And it's just, there's not leaving any, it's just seeing a lot of people being forced out.
Now, James, I'm appreciative of your giving your own personal narrative there, and I wish you good luck and thank you for the call. That's all too common, a story that we're hearing about those hefty rises in rents and unexpected rises. I want to get another caller on from Berkeley, though. David, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was just a little contrarian view here, maybe. I kind of object to the repeated use of these terms during these discussions on this issue about using repeated terms like risk and threats of gentrification, and that this is an inherently almost evil process, and that, you know, the tech workers doing this and these generalizations. But it really is market-driven, is it not? And how there's this presumption about housing that it's, you know, in human life, there's two fundamentals, housing and shelter. I mean, shelter and food. And we have a responsibility to deal with those issues ourselves on a personal level, and there's this presumption of renters that somehow they can occupy someone else's building.
David, we hear the music coming up. Let me get a quick response because we're right at the break here. Miriam?
Yeah, I guess I would just say, although, sure, it is market-driven, but the market is influenced by a lot of different actions, especially actions of the government. And so when we invest in neighborhoods, we're investing in transit in neighborhoods, we're making those more attractive, and we're encouraging the market in those places. So we're saying, in addition to encouraging the market, how about protect the people that are living there and encouraging diversity in those places?
Well, again, you can find out all of what this project has resulted in by going to the map. It's on our website, kqed.org. Thanks to Dan Brecke, our own blogger and online editor, and thanks to Miriam Zook.
Thank you.
Up ahead, Thuck's Breath Mystery Theater.